In the winter of 1844, 69-year-old Lucy Mack Smith sat down with relatively recent convert Martha Jane Knowlton Corey to commit to paper her firsthand account of the history of her son and the church he had founded. Several versions exist of why the project started. It's possible that Lucy approached Martha Jane or vice versa. Also, intriguingly, given the later controversy, Lucy hints that the 12 apostles commissioned the project. Whatever the actual origins of this history, the results are one of the most important sources for Joseph Smith's life, not to mention the first autobiography of a Mormon woman. Who was the woman that created this manuscript? The First Lady of Mormonism's first family. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Lucy Mack was born in 1775, but she always thought it was a year later. As the last of eight children, her family was kind of complicated, and in a lot of ways, it set a pattern for how her future family would be structured. So her father, Solomon Mack Sr., was kind of a jack of all trades. He was a farmer, he was a manufacturer, he was a merchant, shipmaster, real estate investor, and a freighter. So depending on what day of the week it was, he might have been doing something different. He was frequently away from home on adventures. He fought in both the French and Indian War and the Revolutionary War. And because of this, it seems like he entrusted much of the family's religious life to the care of his wife, Lydia Gates. And characteristic of rural life at that time, remember this is long before the advent of modern medicine, much of Lucy's narrative of the family's early years would center on sickness. So her beloved older sisters, Levina and Lovisa, both succumbed at young ages to the dreaded consumption, or what we would call tuberculosis today. Though Lucy describes some miraculous event associated with these illnesses, the all-too-frequent result was a painful, drawn-out death. When she later wrote about Levina's passing, she noted, quote, "The grief it occasioned was preying upon my health and was likely to be a serious injury to me. For months after this, I did not feel as though life was worth seeking after," close quote. So obviously, you can sense her sadness, and it's kind of one of those hints we get that Lucy experienced depression from time to time.
I like that you bring this up, Brian, because depression on the frontier is not unheard of. In fact, as you know, because you've gone through a lot of old journals like I have, depression was quite common. They just didn't have a word for it. But the good thing about not having a word for it means that there was no stigma attached to it. People would get down sometimes and it was known. And especially dealing with grief. When you lived on the frontier, you had to deal with people dying a lot.
And sure, you did happen a lot, but that doesn't mean that you wouldn't be sad about it. And you think about infant mortality rates, you think about things like tuberculosis, diseases that they absolutely did not understand and had zero way of treating. This would have happened all the time. I mean, if you look at your own family history, you go through every family of that time, at least one child on average would have died either at birth or very, very young, and plenty of deaths before adult life. So this was a constant backdrop to people's lives. And so we'll see that crop up many times in Lucy's young life, but then also her married life.
And when we talk about consumption, I mean, that's like the Oregon Trail version of what everyone always had on the plains when they died, you know, like, warning, you've got dysentery, or you died of consumption. I have often thought about why consumption, you know, I thought maybe it meant they, as a Mormon girl growing up where alcohol was forbidden, I thought, well, maybe it meant that they drank alcohol, they consumed alcohol, but that is not what it means. It was tuberculosis, which was an infection of the lungs. And the reason why I understand they called it consumption is because when you got it, it would cause extreme weight loss that would seem to, quote, consume the patient.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up Oregon Trail. We were just playing that at my house, thanks to the DOS archives. And, you know, to us these days, it's hard to understand how pervasive sickness was. And remember, I mean, think how scary illness is now when we have scientific knowledge and modern medicine. I mean, obviously, we can't cure everything, but, I mean, we do have some knowledge to help us out as we deal with these things. Imagine all of this being just a complete mystery. People get sick, you don't know why, and they die, and you don't know why, and you just have to deal with it.
Yeah, and when you read about this, not to get too nitty-gritty into tuberculosis, but it was really an infection. So it would be passed like a cold, a cough or a sneeze, and in these like airborne droplets, and you would get this pain in your chest, and it would be difficult to breathe, and then you could cough with blood. So we always see in like those frontier movies, they're like coughing into a handkerchief and there's blood. They've got the consumption.
So Lucy is really just struggling to come back from this, and her brother Stephen notices that she's having trouble, so he takes her to live with him. And like her other brother Jason, Lucy at this point starts to become a religious seeker. So she's looking all over, trying to figure out where to go in the midst of her anguish here. And then notice how this description of her search sounds very much like how her future prophet son Joseph would describe his search.
She said, quote, "I perused the Bible and prayed incessantly, but one thought interposed itself into all my meditations. If I remained out of any church, all religious people will say that I am of the world. If I join any one church, the rest will all declare that I am in the wrong. No church will say I am right unless I unite with them, and this makes them witnesses against each other. How shall I decide, inasmuch as the Church of Christ was not like any of them?" End quote. So this is a time when Lucy's life is in chaos. You know, in Mormonism, the way that Brian and I grew up, she's sort of this like mythical figure. She's almost become this caricature. We know her as the Great Mother of Israel, right? This great grandmother of Mormonism, but we don't actually really know a lot about her. And we have to remember she was a human being struggling through all of these complicated emotions, just like the rest of us are. So this is a time when a lot of her life is in chaos. And apparently she becomes acquainted with a man who would change the trajectory of her life forever. Joseph Smith. Given the impact on her life that he would make, it's striking to note that her published memoirs only say this, quote, "I became acquainted with a young man by the name of Joseph Smith, to whom I was subsequently married," end quote. Now, just so we're clear, when we're talking about Joseph Smith, that in this particular part, this isn't her son. This is Joseph Smith, her husband and the father of the Prophet of Mormonism.
It's so interesting that she devotes only one sentence to meeting him. I mean, this was romantic Victorian era. It's kind of interesting. And in later times, it seems like they had a reasonably happy marriage. So it's kind of an interesting deal there. And their early married life was pretty ideal. They were happy. Lucy's brother Stephen had given her a very generous wedding present. So this was $1,000, which is about $15,000 in today's values. And that really helped him get started. I mean, this was comparatively wealthy to begin married life. They had two babies, Alvin and Hiram, that came along fairly quickly, and life was pretty much idyllic for them. But in 1802, Lucy develops a nasty cold. It gradually worsens. They call a doctor, and the diagnosis, consumption. So after watching her two sisters be consumed by this disease and die from it, she knew all too well what lay ahead. So she describes a particularly poignant day when Joseph comes to her bedside and exclaims between his sobs, quote, "Oh, Lucy, my wife, you must die. The doctors have all given you up and all say you cannot live."
So she knows that death is likely waiting around the corner, and her mind is obviously troubled by this. She's seen this before. She's no stranger to this disease. So she describes the state of her soul at that point, quote, "I am not prepared to die, for I do not know the ways of Christ, and it seemed to me as though there was a dark and lonely chasm between myself and Christ that I dare not attempt to cross," end quote. And then later on that night, this is really interesting too, and the reason why we're bringing this up is pay attention to the narrative arc. This is something that Joseph Smith Jr., her son, will later adopt and become sort of the skeleton outline for the purpose of Mormonism, for the origins of Mormonism. But it never gets attributed to Lucy. It only gets attributed to her son. So that night, she's laying in bed. She can't sleep. She thinks she's going to die, and she paints a very vivid picture of her spiritual struggle. She says, quote, "Thus I lay all night, my mind at one time raising gradually, borne away to heaven above all height, then reverting back again to my babies and my companion at my side, and I covenanted with God, if he would let me live, I would endeavor to get that religion that would enable me to serve him right, whether it was in the Bible or wherever it might be found, even if it was to be obtained from heaven by prayer and faith. At last a voice spoke to me and said, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be open unto you. Let your heart be comforted. Ye believe in God, believe also in me," end quote. All right, so pay attention. We've heard this story before, but we don't know that this story happened before Joseph Smith Jr. was born. We hear about this happening after, but you can see how this sort of forms the foundation of their family narrative.
From this point on, Lucy is now searching for a religious home. Like Joseph Jr. would do a generation later, she moves from one option to another, searching, reading, questioning. And so after a series of disappointing religious experiments, she concluded, quote, "With a grieved and troubled spirit, I returned, saying in my heart, there is not on earth the religion which I seek. I must again turn to my Bible, taking Jesus and his disciples for an ensample. I will try to obtain from God that which man cannot give nor take away," close quote.
Okay, Brian, I have a question for you about this. So this is obviously the story that we're told that Joseph Smith Jr. tells later on. He's searching for churches. He doesn't know which one to find. Is this a common thing that's happening at this time period?
Definitely. And that's Mormons tend to not know about, or sometimes I would say even care about, context for religious history of this time. So Joseph is kind of seen as that he just comes in a vacuum in a large sense, and his experiences are unique. They're not. There are seekers all over the place, and there are even visions that very much sound like how he will describe what we now call his first vision, at least the early versions of it. And another point we ought to make here is we do have to remember that Lucy's memoirs are being written long after the fact. So we always have to remember time. And we'll talk about this with the first vision later on. When she's writing down these experiences, remember, the first 15 years of Mormon history have already happened. And so there's kind of this symbiotic relationship. So her experiences will inform how Joseph will think about things. And then I think also probably how Joseph experiences things will then inform how she later will remember all of these experiences.
Okay, and we also have to remember that Lucy Mack Smith was born in 1775. And the Second Great Awakening occurs around 1790. So if you do the math, Lucy is a young and impressionable adolescent, I guess, growing up in the Second Great Awakening. And basically, the Second Great Awakening was this marriage of science and religion and philosophy sort of coming out of the American soil. It really peaks in the late 1840s, the Second Great Awakening, The ideas that start percolating are women's rights and abolition and utopian social experiments. This is sort of the flavor and the tenor of the day. So Lucy is a young woman when all of these ideas start percolating in her area. So it makes sense that she would be interpreting death, life and death, and struggle in these new sort of exciting ideas.
So it's picture fire and brimstone sermons on the frontier and encouraging people, they've got to find Jesus. I mean, you can see that in how she's describing her struggle. But for Lucy, church is a big part of this too. So there's certainly a personal aspect to it that you need to have a personal witness of forgiveness of sins and being right with God. But structured religious community is a big part of this too. So it's not just her personal relationship with God, but also where does the church fit into this? Is there a church that she should join? And at the end, her solution is that she finds a minister who will agree to baptize her without requiring her to join his church.
And this is important in the Second Great Awakening because basically you have generations of people who are used to big institutional churches controlling the narrative. They had paid and trained clergy that you would train from your youth to join. And now all of a sudden you're on the American frontier and you don't have all these professional clergy members. And so really, this is why we call Mormonism an American religion, because religion really became sort of a manifest destiny, claim it yourself, pull yourself up by the boots, by your bootstraps, self-invention, right? Anyone could be a preacher. And that's what starts to happen in Western New York. Because you have to remember that this is when the Erie Canal starts to boom with industry. And because of this, you have all this influx of people trying to settle the frontier. And we don't have a lot of professional clergy keeping up. So people start inventing their own religions. And so out of this time period, I'm just going to list a few of the other movements that are founded. So obviously the Latter-day Saint movement, which we're talking about. You have the Millerites, who are like the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Adventists, Seventh-day Adventists, International Bible Students, the Fox Sisters of Hydesville, New York. They started doing seances in the early 1840s. The Shakers come out of this movement, the Oneida Society, the Social Gospel. And then you have a lot of these early feminists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the whole Seneca Falls Convention and a lot of these utopian societies coming around. So when we're talking about Lucy and her story, it makes sense that she sets this up for her family.
In connection with all of these more organized groups, you've also got this nebulous movement of seekers. So these are people that want to go back to a New Testament form of religion, and they're not exactly sure what that means, but they don't feel like any organized religions around them will provide that. And so this will be very important later on, because many important early Mormon converts will come from either unorganized seeker type movements, or even some that have sort of coalesced into a movement. So people like Sidney Rigdon, Pratt, Edward Partridge, some of the very key early people will have this seeker mindset that clearly Lucy partook of and kind of spread that to the rest of her family.
Okay, so modern Mormonism is sort of joked about for their connection to MLMs and, you know, essential oils. We have some of the biggest essential oil companies in the world come out of the Mormon movement, like doTERRA and Young Living Farms and all of that. But this craze wasn't unique to modern times, right? And I want to point this out because Mormonism has this weird tension between like herbal healing and practical medicine. And we're going to talk about that as the podcast goes on. But I want to tell you about an event. This is a major event in Lucy Smith's family that would dictate the family's financial fortunes for the rest of their lives. In a pre-telephone or even a telegraph world, contact with other countries was necessarily limited. But Joseph Smith Sr. became involved in a white-hot business gamble involving China. There was an outbreak of the plague that had created an insatiable demand for cures. And they find this magical, brambly little root called ginseng. Ginseng becomes the craze, and Joseph Smith aimed to cash in. And we don't ever think about how ginseng plays into early Mormonism, but it did. In Lucy's telling of this disaster, Joseph Smith Sr. invested all they had in a shipment of the root, which was to be sold at a high profit in the plague-ridden China. So he invests in this thing. Plague is all the rage right now. We're going to figure out how to do it, and ginseng is going to be the answer. So apparently the sale goes off perfectly. There's no hitch. But their go-between, the intermediary, tells the Smiths that we've lost everything. And the only thing that you've gained is a chest of tea. Well, he's invested all of his money. And so he attempts to recover his profits, but with no luck. To make things worse, Joseph Sr. had racked up debts buying stocks for a general store, hoping to pay it off with the big ginseng windfall. So he invests everything in this ginseng. To liquidate the debts, he was forced to not only sell their farm, but give up Lucy's generous wedding present from her brother. This same brother traveled to Boston to take care of the Smiths' debts. Lucy sadly noted that, quote, "He returned with the receipts, which set us free from embarrassment of debt, but not from the embarrassment of poverty," end quote. And this ginseng disaster would set them up for the rest of their lives to fight and scratch and scrabble to get to the top.
Now, this is another good place to point out that if you find these stories interesting and informative, thank Lucy, because her memoirs are really the only source for all of these stories. Had she not sat down and dictated these events that clearly shape the Smith family and Mormonism, we'd know nothing about them. So it's reasons like this that her memoirs are one of Mormonism's most important sources. And it's no accident that her book was included in a recent history called Foundational Texts of Mormonism. So how did this manuscript come to be? We've got several possibilities. Number one, a family source indicates that Lucy approached 23-year-old Martha Jane Corey during the winter of 1844 and 1845. So Joseph and Hiram have been killed and Nauvoo is sort of settling back into normal. And she uses the winter time when no one is doing farming and they've got some more free time to create her memoirs. Possibility two, Martha, knowing that Lucy has this incredible store of memories, approaches her and suggests that she could transcribe them. Then, possibility three, in a letter to her son William, Lucy suggested that the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles had essentially commissioned her to do it. Now, it seems like possibility one is the most likely, but it's not really, we can't really say for sure. However, the common thread among these three possibilities is that Martha Jane Corey was involved.
Time out. Who is Martha Jane Corey? Martha Jane Knowlton, though of New England stock, took a different path before coming in contact with Mormonism. We hardly ever hear about her and how she was so influential in early Mormonism. She was born in Kentucky but moved from there when still young to Ohio. There she joined the Campbellite Church, a movement that produced several key converts to Mormonism like Sidney Rigdon, Parley P. Pratt, and Wilford Woodruff. By the late 1830s, the family had moved again to Hancock County, Illinois, where they noticed Mormon immigrants from Missouri start to pass through their town. So Martha becomes curious and becomes acquainted with some of their doctrines, and she's intrigued. It was in 1840 that she'd be baptized and quickly immersed herself in the Nauvoo Mormonism. In a later letter, she noted that, quote, "She had been, from the age of 13 years, much in the habit of noting down everything I heard," end quote. But you know what? I could tell you more about Martha Jane Corey, but since this is a Mormon history podcast, I'll let one of her descendants, Tim Corey, a researcher and a fellow podcaster for the Sunstone podcast with John Larson, tell us about his great-great-grandmother, Martha Jane Corey.
Martha Jane Knowlton Corey, my great-great-great-grandmother, was born in Covington, Kentucky, June of 1822. With a precocial desire to know a greater truth, Martha looked for a religion to join. She courted the Campbellite Church, however, because of her young age, they delayed an invitation for her to join, no doubt frustrating Martha. Martha's introduction to Mormonism occurred in 1838 when she was 16. The extermination order from Missouri's Governor Boggs had recently driven many Mormons out of Missouri and into Illinois, where Martha's family lived. Martha's father took pity on the exiled saints, providing some with work and shelter. It was there in Hancock County that Martha became familiar with Joseph Smith and the tenets of Mormonism, which deeply resonated with her. During the time Martha was investigating Mormonism, her sister also sought a closer connection to the divine. Martha's sister invited her once to a séance facilitated by a medium who claimed to be able to communicate with spirits on the other side. When an attendee asked the medium to write down a message from the spirits, the medium complained of an injured arm that prevented her from writing. She then touched Martha, who sat beside her, saying, quote, "Here is a girl who could write if she would," end quote. Immediately, the medium's touch caused Martha to be overcome by glimpses into the darkness, into a world of tortured souls clamoring for her attention, as if to possess her. Martha threw off the medium's hand and stormed out of the séance, saying, quote, "You may be able to hear from the other side, but that is not the kind of spirits I am anxious to meet," end quote. In January of 1840, a hole was cut in the Mississippi River ice and Martha was baptized a Mormon. From that point on, she would give herself completely to her faith. Martha married Howard Corey in Nauvoo in 1841 at the age of 20. Howard had been working as a clerk and a scribe for Joseph Smith, compiling an early church history and copying correspondence into letter books for the prophet. As a young convert to the faith, Martha hung on its leader's every word. Her daughter, Martha Corey Lewis, would later write of her mother, quote, "It was ever her custom when going to a meeting to take a pencil and note paper. She thus preserved notes of sermons that would have otherwise been lost to the church," adding that Wilford Woodruff consulted her notes when he was a church historian for items not to be obtained elsewhere, end quote. Martha's diligent note-taking preserved many blessings, decrees, and sermons, including one of the more detailed accounts of Joseph Smith's 1843 White Horse prophecy. In her husband Howard's reminiscences, he wrote that one night Martha had a troubling dream in their Nauvoo home. She petitioned the prophet's brother, Hiram Smith, to help her interpret the dream. On July 22, 1843, Hiram took the couple by horse-drawn buggy to the outskirts of town, beyond earshot of the neighbors, so they could discuss the matter. Hiram commenced teaching the Corys about the sealing power and the law of plural marriage, which Howard reported was in harmony with his wife's dream. There and then in the buggy, Hiram sealed the two together. Hiram also made clear that the information regarding Smith's revelations on celestial marriage were not yet public information. Sadly, we only have this story as recounted by her husband, and not in Martha's words. Martha's knack for preserving fleeting moments in church history is no doubt why Lucy Mack Smith personally asked her to serve as her scribe as she told her family history. This effort still provides one of the deepest looks into the Smith family and early Mormonism. Serving as Mother Smith's amanuensis proved to be a larger task than Martha originally thought. Martha received permission from Brigham Young to discontinue her work in Nauvoo teaching school to begin the work inscribing the book. Later, Howard would also quit teaching school and join the effort, explaining why both Corey's handwriting can be seen throughout the book's notes and drafts. They gave a copy of the manuscript to Mother Smith and retained another copy, which they delivered to the brethren upon their arrival in Salt Lake. Despite Martha's leading efforts in compiling the manuscript, Howard was given recognition and pay. On January 14, 1846, Bishop Newell K. Whitney authorized payment to Howard Corey of, quote, $200 for compiling the history of Lucy Smith, mother of the prophet Joseph, and $35 for transcribing it, end quote. Martha and Howard Corey regarded the work they were engaged in with Mother Smith as a sacred duty. Of the schisms that formed following the martyrdom, they believed that whichever proved to be the best steward of the Smith history must also be the proper successor of the faith. This is somewhat ironic, since in 1865, Brigham Young would strongly censure the book, publicly using Martha as a scribal scapegoat for what was likely disagreements in the prophetic succession claims of William Smith and doctrinal disagreements with Orson Pratt, whose publication of the book was done without Young's permission. One might think that Brigham Young's strong denunciation of Martha's words would shake Martha's faith. After all, what she dedicated upwards of 2 years to transcribe, Young very publicly wrote off as, quote, a novel and a tissue of falsehoods, end quote. Still, Martha's belief in the gospel and support of the man she believed to lead it caused her to continue sustaining Young, but not without correcting the record. In an 1865 letter to Young regarding Mother Smith and her book, Martha wrote, quote, I was her amanuensis at the time the book was written. First, allow me to state the cause of my being found in that position. I was, and had been from the age of 13, much in the habit of noting down everything I heard and read which possessed any peculiar interest to me, in order to preserve facts. At this time, I was occupied from time to time, as occasion offered, in making notes of sermons and other things which I thought reliable, such as discourses by yourself, the 12, and other responsible men. This made it an easy task for me to transmit to paper what the old lady said, and prompted me in undertaking to secure all the information possible for myself and children. Further, I hoped her simple stories might be compiled in a small book for the reading of the young. Mother Smith was, at the time she gave her history, in a very low state of health, at times suffering great pains with rheumatism, and often much suffocated with an affliction of the chest. The baleful influence of her evil-minded son William was another great cause of confusion. Hiram and Joseph were dead, and thus, without their aid, she attempted to prosecute the work, relying chiefly upon her memory, having little recourse to authenticate statements whose corresponding dates might have assisted her. The book, when finished by me, required a thorough revision by those who possessed better facilities for correcting it than were accessible to me. There were two manuscripts prepared. One copy was given to Mother Smith and the other retained in the church. The first copy fell into the hands of Mr. Arthur Milliken, Mother Smith's son-in-law, and then went from him, I hear, to A.W. Babbitt, Esquire, and afterwards came into the possession of an editor named Sheen, and was sold by him to Elder Orson Pratt, who took it to England and published it in its crude state. The preface, printed by Elder Orson Pratt, claims that the work was mostly written under the supervision of Joseph Smith. This was not true, as it was not commenced until some time after his death. Mother Smith was a kind, warm-hearted, noble, and good woman. She rejoiced in her family and had a natural desire to perpetuate their memory. And, trusting too much to recollection, she was in some things mistaken. But who has thus never been mistaken? I wrote the book, and my statements were faithful and true as far as I could learn at the time. But upon further information, I am convinced that it contains many unavoidable errors, and should not have been printed in its present form, but being printed should have been suppressed. I expected that it would pass through the hands of the church historian, but, as it did not, its publication seems to have been improper. Sir, with respect and honor, I remain your sister in the bonds of the Holy Gospel, M. J. Corey. End quote. Brigham Young appointed Martha to serve on the board of trustees at Brigham Young Academy. She was the only woman in that original body. Some have supposed that this was intended to be an apology from Young, following his comments on Martha and her work in Mother Smith's book. I, however, believe that Martha came by this appointment honestly. As a lifelong frontierswoman, writer, teacher, chemist, promoter of democracy and education, wife, and mother, Martha Jane Knowlton Corey's obituary was carried in papers throughout the territory, and accounts of her impressive funeral were printed a few days later. A special train was ordered that carried mourners from Salt Lake to Provo, where the tabernacle was filled to capacity to celebrate the life of a very honorable woman. An epitaph on her headstone reads, quote, "While a loiterer among the poor, she was a teacher of the learned. God and nature were her preceptors, humanity was her religion, and maternal sacrifice her idolatry." End quote. A final quick note about Martha Jane Knowlton Corey. If you enjoyed what you heard about her in this episode, look for an upcoming miniseries on Sunstone in which I dive deeper into Martha and Howard's lives. You'll be shocked by Martha's response to polygamy when Howard brought a second wife home, and how she masked her identity to enter and influence courtrooms, and the liquid lightning oil that she made that would supposedly cure a calf or stop an assailant in his tracks. A big thank you to Levina Fielding Anderson, Sandra and Gerald Tanner, Elizabeth Ann Anderson, Amy Reynolds Billings, Sherilyn Howcroft, the Daughters of Utah Pioneers Museum, and the L. Tom Perry Special Collections staff at BYU for their patient assistance in this project.
During that winter of 1844 to 1845, Lucy sits down and dictates her memoirs to Martha Jane. And the process of creating a finished manuscript was incredibly complicated. So we'll link to a chart that shows all of these different sources. So you've got various different rough drafts, you have different finished, quote-unquote, fair copies, but you have all of these other sources that are floating in along the way. It's a really interesting and incredibly complex process. But so by the end of late 45 or early 1846, they finish two fair copies. So they decide to give one to Lucy, and then the other one goes to the church somehow. And as best as we can figure out, in 1853, Almon Babbitt, a Mormon leader, is on his way back east. So he stops in Nauvoo, where much of the Smith family, including Lucy Sr., decided to stay, and he takes her copy of the manuscript and brings it to Washington, D.C., where he gives it to Orson Pratt. Pratt is just about to leave for England to oversee the mission there, so he takes the manuscript with him, and he has Samuel Richards print it. Now, he does all of this without notifying Brigham Young, and apparently not even Lucy. But later on, he writes her a letter, and he told her he would give her $100, and then he would also give her 10 copies of the book. So she apparently ended up only getting 8. And what's really fun is at the bookstore where I work, Benchmark Books, we have actually had one of those that she gave to her namesake daughter, Lucy Jr. Beautiful book. Full leather copy with tooling on the leather and gilt edges and an inscription inside. Just an incredible piece of literally of Mormon history.
Okay, so they publish this book without Brigham Young or Lucy knowing. So how does Brigham Young react?
Well, he's not happy, but it takes a while for that to manifest. So the book is published in 1853. 2 years later, he does publish a statement where he argues that there were some errors, and he hints that a quote-unquote corrected edition would be published. So what he does is he apparently tells Wilford Woodruff, an apostle and the assistant church historian, that the historian's office would need to go through the manuscript, fix the errors, and they start it, but they run out of steam very quickly. And as Levina Fielding Anderson, who is the editor of a critical edition of Lucy's History, noted, quote, "An examination of the materials available documenting Brigham Young's reaction suggests that he was really angry at Pratt over doctrinal matters and, about half the time, while dressing him down in public and in private, simply threw in biographical sketches for good measure," close quote. So there was this bad doctrinal blood between Brigham Young and Orson Pratt. It's notorious enough that an entire book was written about it, which is fantastic. But then, in 1865, Brigham really goes nuts about the book.
Yeah, and again, we need to pay attention to Brigham and Orson Pratt's feud, because that's going to come into play later on in history. So it starts here with all of this. So this might shock some of you, but Brigham Young could really go off at the pulpit. I bet you didn't know that about him. And like some of his other tirades, this one seems to come way out of left field. So here's the setting. He's in Wellsville for a meeting, and he noticed a copy of the book at Ezra T. Benson's house. Brigham was so pissed off about this that he makes this book the entire theme of his talk. He starts going off. He calls it a tissue of falsehoods, which I love, tissue of falsehoods. And then thundered, quote, "I require the 12, the high priests, the 70s, and the bishops, and everyone in the church, male and female, if they have such a book, to destroy it," end quote. The report originally said that he said to burn it up, but that was crossed out. But my money is that Brigham Young did say to burn it, but it was too hot to stay in the minutes, so they took it out. In the published version, he told people they could get tithing credit if they turned them in. Once again, the historian's office was ordered to fix it so they could publish a corrected edition, and once again, they start but run out of steam. So it's not until 1902 that the church serializes a somewhat revised version and then published it in a book form. The moral of the story? Nevertheless, Lucy's history persisted.
We do talk about Lucy, but like Lindsay said, it's more this caricature, this mother in Israel. And I mean, Mormon leaders would even kind of pigeonhole her into this caricature, but she clearly was far more than this. Hopefully you've noticed so far that her religious outlook and her way of approaching religious doubt clearly influenced her children. I mean, most notably, Joseph Smith. The Mormon history starts with this soul search that Lucy had done a generation earlier. So we really need to credit her for the role that she played in the development of Mormonism.
Okay, Brian, I just want to talk about something kind of fun for a minute, because there was this rumor going around for a long time, and we have these funny rumors from time to time. Like, there's this great rumor that Mormons like to tell that sort of gained popularity, that the hearse at the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland was Brigham Young's hearse or something like that. I don't know what it is, but we think we're the center of the universe sometimes. So this rumor was floating around that Joseph Smith Sr. invented root beer, right? The root beer, the drink, because Mormons are known for drinking root beer. And it is true that the Smith family brewed root beer, but a lot of farmers at the time were making drinks out of roots. And so this is pretty popular. And I think officially root beer became an official drink in like 1877 or something, when some of the root beer companies formed. But no, the Smiths did not invent root beer, but they were definitely making root beer. And that brings me to talking about Lucy as a root doctor. I always call her an herb witch because I like that. She was very interested in herbs and the potency. And this sort of comes into contact with this Thompsonian medicine at the time. Do you want to tell us what that was?
So we're obviously long before modern medicine. And so there were different schools of thought on how you would deal with illness. So you had one that would go towards more heroic methods. So these are the doctors that are administering calomel. You may remember that Joseph Smith Jr.'s older brother, Alvin, was treated with a dose of this that apparently was what killed him. So it was heavily, had a lot of mercury in it, and, you know, it wasn't going to cure anything, and if you got too much of it, would kill you. So as kind of a reaction to this style of medicine, you had the Thompsonians, who would look more to roots and herbs and more natural types of healing. And it seems that Lucy, like so many others, thought that this was a much better approach than the heavy medicines that really didn't work either.
And again, sort of buried in the archives, erased in history, is Lucy's impact on the Word of Wisdom, the Mormon health code that would develop later on. And of course, that's a complicated subject for another day. But Mormons are cautioned against hot drinks, and this is a Thompsonian idea. And Joseph Smith really sort of latched on to some of these ideas because he was given certain herbs that would upset his stomachs. Joseph Smith had a lot of stomach problems. But Lucy Mack Smith instilled this idea in him to experiment with these herbs. One of the herbs at the time was lobelia. It was a plant found in this area. And what they would normally do is just like brew. It was basically brewing a lot of tea with a bunch of alcohol. So they would just take all these herbs and put them in alcohol. But I'm going to read you. This is from Thompson's book called New Guide to Health or Botanic Family Physician, published in 1822. This is a home remedy that you could take to cure a litany of ailments. Quote, 1 ounce of the emetic herb, 2 ounces of cayenne, 1/2 pound bayberry root bark in powder, 1 pound poplar bark, 1 pint of the rheumatic drops. This stock will be sufficient for a family for 1 year with such articles as they can easily procure themselves when wanted and will enable them to cure any disease which a family of common size may be afflicted with during that time. The expenses will be small and much better than to employ a doctor and have this extravagant bill to pay, end quote. This is important. We cannot underestimate the Smith's poverty. Out of the poverty, out of this frontier, out of this burned over district, we have someone like Lucy who is searching for self-made religion and self-made medicine. This is how you did it on the frontier. You were poor, and so you got creative, and that's where we get Mormonism, and this is where we get a lot of Lucy's early herbal remedies. And another thing is, Brian and I we've been trying to talk about what she looked like, but it's been kind of challenging. We wanted to give you a physical description. We really only have one painting.
Yeah, there's the most common image. If you were to see it, you'd probably recognize it. It was a drawing done by Frederick Piercy, and he included it in a collection. It was kind of like a travel guide almost. So for immigrants coming from England to Utah. And so he put that in there. So you, like I said, we'll link to that and you'll probably recognize it. There's another side shot of her done by Sutcliffe Maudsley. It's really a fun image. She's in a rocking chair underneath a framed facsimile from the Book of Abraham. You may remember that she was allowed to give people tours of the mummies and the papyrus for a time to kind of help support her. But that's about it. And obviously these are both of her late in life. And for a long time, those were the only known images. But then, kind of a very interesting set of circumstances came about. So in the 1950s, and the RLDS Church was doing a little bit of restoration on the mansion house in Nauvoo, and this man found a painting up in the attic. It was unlabeled, undescribed, and so it just kind of, you know, it was a period painting was really all they could say. Then later on, some descendants of David Hiram Smith, this was the son of Joseph Smith Jr. and Emma that was born after he was killed. So his descendants had a trunk that had been passed down through the family. And in going through this, Lachlan Mackay, who has been a big force in Community of Christ history enterprises and is now actually an apostle. So he's going through this, and he finds a packet of pictures that is labeled Mother Smith's Pictures. That's all it said. So he's going through, and what does he find? But an early, it was called a Daguerrean button. So it was a small circular image, possibly for a brooch. And he's looking at it, and they compared it to this painting that they had found in the mansion house. And it seems very clear that this painting was based off this daguerreotype image. And so after investigating it, they're pretty confident that this is actually a photograph of Lucy Mack Smith, which was fascinating. And they, you know, they compared it to other known photographs of her children and other relatives and other historical research and came to the conclusion that it probably was of her.
And basically what she looks like is she's thin. Of course, this picture and the painting are of her you know, later on in life. But it was said that her eyes were piercing just like her son, Joseph Smith. So we think that the piercing Smith eyes come from her.
And that might be an insight into her charisma. It's interesting, if you look at the family dynamics, everyone seemed to love and appreciate Joseph Smith Sr., but he wasn't really a take-charge person. You know, he's mostly in the background for Mormon history. But Lucy, there are several occasions where she really shows her gift for organization and management. And so it seems that her sons, Joseph Smith Jr. in particular, may have inherited a lot of his charismatic gifts from his mother.
It's certainly the case that he develops a spiritual trajectory based on her sort of narrative of seeking, can't find the right answer. But we can't underestimate this impact, this American identity of you could go settle the West and make it your own. You could go find property and make it your own. This is a time that like sort of predates the Homestead Act, where people could, you know, set out and claim their own land. But what you could do is you could claim your own religion. You could claim your own medicine. You could really make a name for yourself and sort of move past the sort of class system that came from a lot of, you know, the immigrants in Europe, where they were stuck in a job and in a career and a vocation for the rest of their lives. And so I really see this as some of the foundations for early Mormonism.
One last fun fact about Lucy that you may not know. As far as we can tell, she was the first woman to speak in General Conference. And it happened in October 1845. So if you think about the course of larger Mormon history now, so Joseph and Hiram Smith have been killed, and for a time, life had settled back to normal, but it became increasingly clear that Mormons were going to have to leave Illinois. And so there are initial plans. You know, this is where Council of 50 is exploring new settlement options and just trying to figure out where they're going to go. And as part of this, they're trying to figure out how the Smith family is going to fit into this. And obviously, you're probably well aware that Emma, Joseph Smith Jr.'s wife, and Brigham Young, who is the sort of de facto leader of the Saints at this point, did not get along well. Emma did not like polygamy. She was not a fan of Brigham Young's, you know, people skills. Many people would feel that way at the time and later. And the question of the rest of the Smith family, where were they going to follow Brigham Young's leadership? Were they going west? And so this is the backdrop for Lucy being invited to speak. And she talks about kind of the just general conditions in Nauvoo. And then what's really interesting is apparently toward the end of her remarks, she kind of tails off. So she is 70 years old at this time, which if you think about life expectancy rates, she's old. And so Brigham Young then gets up and says, well, many people may not have heard what Lucy said at the end there. And so I'll kind of recap it. And then he says, and Lucy has said she's going to join us. And I have to think that part of that is Brigham saying, look, see, Lucy's following me, then the rest of you probably should too. So that's the kind of the background for her remarks. And luckily, those were taken down by actually two reporters at the conference. And so we actually have her remarks. And here they are.
We're going to have Mormonism's own special mother in Israel, Carolyn Pearson, read the transcript for Lucy Mack Smith. Now remember, this is the first account ever that we've had of a woman speaking in General Conference. So this is a pretty big deal.
Well, brothers and sisters, I have been looking around upon this congregation. I have long been waiting for the time when the Lord would give me strength to look upon you and my children I feel solemn. I want everyone to look into their hearts and see what they have come to this place for, whether they have come to follow Christ through evil and good report or for any other cause. I want to give you my advice. I want to have time to talk about my husband and Hiram and Joseph. I want to give you all my advice. Brigham Young has done the errand. He has fixed it completely. For a long time, I have been wanting to ask whether you would be willing to receive stolen goods or not. I want to know if you believe in such things. There is one thing I want to speak of. There is maybe 2,000 people here that never were acquainted with Mr. Smith or my family. I raised up 11 children, 7 boys. I raised them in the fear of God. When they were 2 or 3 years old, I told them I wanted them to love God with all their hearts. I told them to do good. I want all you to do the same. God gives us our children, and we are accountable. In the fear of God, I warn you. I want you to take your little children and to teach them in the fear of God. I want you to teach them about Joseph in Egypt and such things. And when they are 4 years old, they will love to read their Bible. I presume they're never was a family more obedient than mine. I did not have to speak to them only once. Set your children to work and try to bring them up to your comfort. Don't let them play out of doors. If I can't talk to a few thousands here, how can I meet millions and talk in the celestial glory? I want the young men to remember that I love children, young folks, and everybody. I want them to be obedient to their parents, be good and kind, and do in secret as you would do in the presence of millions. I call you brothers and sisters and children. If you consider me a mother in Israel, I want you to say so. Oh, I hear yes, 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 yes. Thank you, thank you. My feelings have been hurt by hearing them say, "Old Mother Smith." There goes Old Mother Smith. I have had my feelings hurt a great deal. I want to speak about the dead. It was 18 years ago, last 22nd of September, that Joseph took the plates out of the earth. And it was 18 years last Monday since Joseph, the prophet of the Lord. It was in a morning my son came to me and told me he had taken those plates out of the ground. And he said, "Go and tell all 3 of the Harrises that I have taken the plates out of the ground, and I want Martin should assist me. I want to take off some of the characters and send them to New York." I am now in my 70th year. It is 18 years since I began to receive the gospel of glad tidings to all people. I have got it all in a history, and I want this people to be so good and so kind as to get it printed before you go west. Martin Harris was the first person that helped Joseph go about this work to get the Book of Mormon printed, for the gospel could not be preached until this was done. Here was only my family and Martin Harris to do anything about it. Just as soon as they commenced, the devil began to roar and attempt to destroy them. But a little while before we were turned out of house and home, Joseph went to Pennsylvania. Hiram and Samuel had to go and work in the woods all day, and then at night had to go haul the wood and get means to help Joseph to publish the book. Two of them guarded the house. This was the way it commenced. And now, see what a congregation is here who talk about going to the West and how easy this can be done. My family could go to work and get means to print the Book of Mormon. Do not be discouraged and say that you can't get wagons and things. As Brigham says, you must be all honest or you will not get there. If you feel cross, you will have trouble. My family made out to get the book printed. The angel of the Lord told them what to do. They began 18 years ago last Monday. Thousands have come into the church since then and have not known Joseph, Hiram, Don Carlos, or William. And they are all gone, but poor William. And he is gone, I don't know where. I have three daughters at home. They have never had anything but it worked for the church. After the book was printed, Samuel took some of them to sell and was turned out of doors three times. He went into Brother Green's Methodist preacher. Samuel said, "Don't you want to buy a book?" She asked, "What is it?" Samuel said, "It is a Book of Mormon that my brother Joseph has translated from plates out of the ground." She asked her husband, but he would not buy. Samuel left one till he returned. He had to sell them to buy us victuals. I want to speak of this that you may not complain of hard times. He went into a house and asked to have a breakfast, and he would give a book for it. He again went to Sister Green. She said he must take the book again. Samuel took the book and looked and looked. She afterwards told me she never saw a man look so. She knew that he had the Spirit of God. He said, "The Spirit forbids me taking this book." She knelt and asked him to pray with her. She read the book and became a Mormon. And thus the work began. And then it spread like a mustard seed. After the church began to grow, we were driven from one place to another, to Kirtland, then to Missouri. William was taken sick, Samuel's wife and others, and I had 20 or 30 sick to take care of during the mobbing. I felt strong in health. I could take care of 30 sick then, better than sit on my chair now. While William lay sick, he had a vision and saw the mob come in. He said he saw them come in thousands and thousands, and he said, Mother, you will be driven. And, says he, if I die, I want you to take care of my wife. I want you to carry my corpse wherever you go. The first day, William was able to walk as far as the door. The mob came. 10 of them came into my room after they had taken Joseph and Hiram into their camp. There were thousands of them hallowing and screeching in my ears. How do you think I felt? Have you any feelings for me? While they were in the camp, I could not go to see them. And now, my children are in the grave. 10 men came in and said, we have come in to kill the heads of the family. Says I, do you want to kill me? They said, yes. I said, I want you to do your work quick, for I would then be happy. Then they said, God damn it, these Mormons had as lief die as live. Then they tried Joseph and Hiram and sentenced them to be shot in 15 minutes. A man came in and said, Mother Smith, if you ever want to see Joseph again, you must go now, for he is going to be shot in Jackson County. He took me by the hand, and it was as much as we could do to get through the crowd to the wagon. The men lifted up their swords and swore I should not see them. I finally got to the wagon and put up my hand. He took hold of my hand and kissed it. I said, Joseph, let me hear your voice once more. Said he, God bless you, my poor mother. They were taken away. They were in bands and irons. All this time, my son William and his wife were sick. Samuel's wife was sick and some others, and I had them all to take care of. After that, we had to move. Joseph then went to the city of Washington. It rained 3 days as hard as it could rain, but we had to travel and nothing to shelter us. I walked 6 miles in the bottom. My clothes were wet so high up I could scarcely walk. And when we got to the Quincy River, it snowed. It rained. It hailed. We lay our bed on the cold snow and a blanket over us and took off our wet stockings and did the best we could. In the morning, the cover was frozen stiff. We could not make a fire for the snow. Joseph then went to the city of Washington as he had a revelation to importune at the governor's feet and the president's feet. And the Lord said if they would not heed him, he would vex the nation. When he got home, he preached. Down between Mr. Durfee's and the mansion house, he told the brethren and sisters that he had done all he could for them. Says he, they are determined we shall not have justice while we stay in Nauvoo. But, says he, keep good courage. You shall never suffer for bread as you have done before. Said he, all these cases are recorded on earth. And what is recorded here is recorded in heaven. Now, says he, I am going to lay this case of their taking away our property, etc. I am going to take it up before the highest court in heaven. He repeated it 3 times. Little did I think he was going to leave us so soon to take this case to heaven. We never could get justice till he took it there. The Lord has got even the marshal there. They know all our sufferings, and don't you think our case is being tried? I think they will do more for us there than they could if they were here. I feel that if every soul would stay at home, they would be blessed. I feel as though God is vexing the nation a little here and there. And I feel that the Lord will let Brother Brigham take the people away. I don't know as I shall go, but if the rest of my family go, I will go. And I pray that the Lord may bless the heads of the church, Brother Brigham, and all of you. And when I go to another world, I want to meet you all. Here lays my dead, my husband, and children. I want to lay my bones here, so that in the resurrection I can raise with my husband and children, if so be that my children go, and I would to God that all my children would go. They will not go without me. And if I go, I want to have my bones fetched back to be laid with my husband and children.
Before we close with that amazing talk, it's time for our special segment, a recommendation for your homework, your extra reading, and book club. It's our new feature called our Books of Mormon Review, where every episode we highlight one key book you should definitely know about.
So we've talked in this episode about Lucy Mack's history, and you probably gathered it's a bit of a complex subject. And so for years, what you had was either originals or photo reprints of the first printed edition from 1853, and then the slightly revised edition published by the church in 1902. But there are revisions before that, there are revisions in between those two, and what was needed was a good critical edition of all of this. So historian Levina Fielding Anderson edited a book called Lucy's Book, and what she does is she presents the rough drafts and the first published version. And then in the annotation, she talks about all the different pieces of editing that happened. And so in some cases, you'll see that there are huge chunks that either appeared in the rough draft, but not in the published version, or vice versa. And there's also some excellent essays that talk about Lucy's domestic spirituality, and then also the complicated and fascinating history of how this book came to be. So we highly recommend you reading that. It's one of those pieces where the book itself is interesting, but the history of how the book came to be is almost as interesting.
And like I said, we're going to try to highlight a book every episode. What we want you to do, what we're hoping you'll do, is you'll go buy this book and read it. Start a book club, follow along with the podcast. When I hosted Year of Polygamy, we had book clubs built around the whole podcast, and we're inviting you to do that. So this week's reading is this book. So you want to pick up Lucy's book, a critical edition of Lucy Mack Smith's family memoir, edited by Levina Fielding Anderson, holy is her name, you can buy it on signaturebooks.com.
It's unfortunately out of print, but thanks to Signature Books, the publisher of this, the full text of it is available on their website. So we'll link to that so that you can dive in.
Brother Young, and let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.